This is Tax Chats. Hello, I'm Scott Dyring.
And I am Jeff Hoops.
And we're here to chat
about taxes.
Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Tax Chats. I'm Scott Dyring, professor of accounting at Duke University. And I am joined, as always, by my friend and colleague at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the curator and the CEO and the janitor of the Tax Museum, Jeffrey L. Hoops. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Scott D. Dyring.
You don't even know what D in the middle stands for, do you?
Douglas.
Oh, you do know. Wow, very good. All right. I know
what
else
stands for. I have a long story about Douglas, but I will not share it.
You do? Okay. Yes. Everybody who was born in like the late 40s was named Douglas, I think after Douglas MacArthur from World War II, and then that name fell out of favor. And then I've also discovered the only people named Scott that I know are roughly my age. I think it was popular for about 5 years. And my mom must have been on the bandwagon.
There's a few more Scotts than just 5 years, but that's okay, Scott.
Not that many. Anyway. All right. Well, usually we have to have a little talk about the Tax Museum. And is there anything happening over there today?
Always something happening at the Tax Museum, as usual.
Have you acquired any new artifacts for the museum lately?
I have many new artifacts, actually.
Anything you want to mention on the air?
Not in particular.
Okay.
They're all secret artifacts. You have to come and visit.
Come and visit. Well, I think we need to do another audio tour of the Tax Museum. So maybe in the future we'll do another audio tour of the Tax Museum. We have done one. People can go look that up in the archives of the Tax Chats, but maybe in the future. But that's not what we're doing today. Today we're going to do something else. What are we going to do?
We are talking with Martha Gimbel. Martha, do you want to introduce yourself briefly?
Hi, my name is Martha Gimbel. I'm executive director of the Budget Lab at Yale, which is a new academic center focused on budget scoring. Before that, I was at the Council of Economic Advisors. I was at Schmidt Futures. I was at Indeed. I was at Joint Economic Committee, Department of Labor, done a bunch of stuff in economic policy.
It might be easier to just to give us the list of places you haven't been.
Yes. Well, I do want to take this moment to say that I also, perhaps most importantly for this conversation, have a cousin named Scott. So I feel like I should be shouting out.
Oh, wait, wait, moment. Yeah. Hang on. How old is Scott? Is Scott in his mid-40s?
So I just looked this up, and Scott is about 13 years younger than you are.
Oh, man. That's okay. So I was wrong. So my anecdotes did not prove to be true.
But outside the 5-year window,
which is true 100% of the time.
Yeah, but I will say I actually have looked up, just for the record, I have looked up popularity of the name Scott, and it definitely peaked in the mid-70s when I was born. So
just like you.
And you know, often we go to the Tax Museum, but today we're going to a lab. So that's going to be a new exciting thing to us. So we're going to a lab today.
Yeah, so can you tell us a little bit? You gave us a one sentence summary of the budget lab. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what the budget lab is, and we'll talk about how it got installed and started, and who's involved and all that. But just first of all, tell us what it is.
Yeah, so for those of you who follow congressional budget scoring very closely, which for listeners of this podcast, maybe almost all of you, but just in case, when a piece of legislation is proposed or gets to a certain point in the process, the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Committee on Taxation will score it, and they will say how much it costs. And they will generally look over a 10-year period. And I was working in the Biden administration with my co-founders, Danny Yagan and Natasha Sarin, and we just started thinking about the ways that, you know, budget scoring makes such a huge difference in the policy process, but it doesn't take into account a lot of things that we care about in policy. So for instance, impacts. When you're thinking about an investment, you care not just what it costs, but also what you're getting from that investment. And that is just by design, not part of the congressional scoring process.
So what would be an example of a law where the impact was like ignored just very briefly?
So I will give you an example of a law where it was not ignored, which was unusual. So when they scored the Affordable Care Act, they included the change in the uninsurance rate. That was very unusual. But it meant that when people were having conversations about the ACA and then about repealing the ACA, it wasn't just about the cost of the plan. It was also about how many people will get or lose insurance if we do these things. And that fundamentally changes the equation of how you're thinking about it. You know, the way I always put it to people, right, is if you go out and buy a coat, you don't come home and say to your partner, like, honey, I spent $50, period. You say, I spent $50 on a coat.
It's like we're at business school. It's like a return on assets and all you know, or return on investment. And all you know is how much you spend on the investment without knowing anything about the return. You have half of the fraction.
Right, exactly.
And not the other half.
Well, not only that, you don't even know, not only the return, you don't even know what you got for the investment. It's like, I went out and spent $1 million. It's like, well, what did you buy with it?
Right. Was that a good, was that too much? Was that too little? There are plenty of things that government does because they want a monetary return. And that can be reflected in things like dynamic scoring, if dynamic scoring is done. You know, there are also things that we do for non-economic reasons. The other example I give people is, at various points in 2022, I'm going to get the exact numbers right here, so please don't hold me to these exact numbers that I'm saying. But sending arms to Ukraine at one point was adding something like 20 basis points onto quarterly annualized GDP. Great. That's not why we sent arms to Ukraine, right? We sent arms to Ukraine because invading other countries is bad and you should not do it.
If we were just in for the GDP increase, we could have just sent the same number to Russia and doubled the impact on GDP.
100%. Yes, exactly. And so it's really important to think about what you're doing, why you're doing it, and are you getting the ROI that you think you're getting?
Well, but it's not just ROI, right? Isn't it also, I mean, it is, that's a big part of it, but isn't it also like the social...
There's a social return to using return broadly.
Return is broadly.
Yes. When you think about, I mean, so as an example, one thing that we're thinking about right now at the Budget Lab is paid family leave. One benefit of paid family leave is that you have lower neonatal and maternal mortality. There are economic benefits to that, and you know, there's impacts on the budget. I think people also generally feel that there is a benefit to fewer mothers and babies dying.
Like babies that are alive.
We like babies that are alive. That is sort of a base level.
And mothers that are alive. And,
yes, yeah. Thank you. On behalf of the mothers, thank you. And so, you know, you can put economic numbers on that, but also just base level, the lives saved has value.
Yeah, just the principle of life is important and we value life and we want to save it. That's like, it's hard to even put a number on it, right? So it's useful to think about that.
Well, yeah. We're economists, so we can put a number on anything, but yes.
Well, I know, we put numbers on everything. It's true, which is a little bit morbid sometimes,
it's
but it is.
Terribly it's morbid. It's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess that kind of leads to my next question. I mean, there are other organizations that do budget scoring.
Yes. Right?
That tells the cost of things. So is the primary difference between the Budget Lab your kind of emphasis on what you actually get for the cost? Or what is the difference between you and, say, Penn Wharton Budget Model or the CBO or JCT or other people that occasionally have something to do with scores?
Tax Policy Center. Yes. So the big difference is that we are trying to kind of widen the aperture of what is included in scoring conversations. And it's not just on the impact side. We're also looking over a longer period of time. So we do conventional scoring. We do it over 10 years, but we are also looking at things over 30 years.
And the window often is like a huge deal and a huge trick in the scoring process. So 30 years is important.
Right. And there's a lot of tricks that people play, as we all know, to try to get things to look good in 10 years. But sometimes they don't look as good 15 or 20 years out.
Like every time, pretty much?
I mean, basically every time. But also, if you're thinking about impacts, you need to, for many things the government does, you need to look at more than 10 years. The way that I always put this is, you know, no five-year-old has had a return on investment in 10, from a budget perspective. I've had some people say, like, I feel that my investments in my five-year-old have paid off in 10 years. I'm like, right, for you, but not for the federal government.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you make an investment in a five-year-old, from a budget perspective, they are still they still require budgetary outlays when they are 15.
I was about to say they're like a sucking vacuum, but I guess they require budget outlays. Is a nicer way of saying
it. I was trying to avoid saying something like leech on the body politic. But yes, exactly. But over the long run, you know, we know that investing in children has benefits. But if you're looking at 10 years, you're not going to see a lot of
them. Yeah. So when you say we, you know, here at the Tax Museum, for example, I use we all the time, and we do a lot of things at the Tax Museum, but there's very few people involved in that we. At the Budget Labs, when you say we...
Wait, let's clarify. When Jeff says we, he means one.
It's the royal we.
There's just one person involved in we. The royal we.
The royal we.
Not only the president, but I'm also... what was the Rogaine? I'm not only the founder, but also a user. It's like something like that. Yeah. Anyway, so who is involved at the... So it's you. Who else? Well, not only specific people, but like how do they all come together? What types of people are there? Tell us more about the team at the Budget Lab.
So the team is large, and we are very grateful that we've been able to hire the people we have, because frankly, if it were just me, Danny, and Natasha, it would be the three of us sitting in a room going, don't you think someone should do this? And the other one's going, yes, someone should. So we've hired some people to do it. So we have Rich Prisanzano, who's joined us from the Penn Wharton budget model. He's also spent time at Treasury. We have Ernie Tedeschi.
He's also been a guest on Tax Chats.
A famous, famous tax guy.
Yes. Yes.
We also have Ernie Tedeschi, who just left the Council of Economic Advisors, was previously at Evercore. John Rico, also from the Penn Wharton budget model. Harris Epsteiner, who just came to us from his PhD at Harvard. We have Josh Kendall, who's our research fellow, who's the person who actually understands how all of the computing works. We're very grateful for Josh. We've had a series of amazing part-time RAs. Sarah Robinson was working with us while she was doing her PhD at Harvard. Sophia Syed, who's a law student at YLS, although in a recent Axios article, they referred to her as a associate professor at Yale, which, to be clear, is a title we feel she deserves very much and expect the school to make it happen any day now.
But has to graduate first.
I mean, Axios says she doesn't, so I think we're good to go. And then we have our undergraduate RAs, Jay Philbrick, Larry Jia, Annabelle Zhing, and Thomas Treedman. And then last but most certainly not least, we have our program coordinator, Silva Krober, who's the person who makes sure that everything actually gets done.
So is there like a physical place where all of these people are, or are you all remote, or what? If I wanted to visit the Budget Lab, where would I go?
In your spirit, Jeff, you would visit us in your spirit. No, we are fully remote. Silva is based out of Yale, but otherwise we are distributed across states that Yale has approved for remote work.
So I'm noticing on the Budget Lab people, you have a tab here for staff, then advisory board, which is a very, very impressive advisory board, but let's not talk about that. You have a tab for dogs.
Yes, we do.
Tell me about the dogs of the Budget Lab.
The dogs of the Budget Lab are incredibly important. So the way this originally got started is Natasha, Danny, and I all have dogs, and we used to take our dogs to the dog park on the weekend, and the dogs would chase each other and jump on each other, and we would discuss our frustrations with the budget scoring process. And so when we started this, we said, well, we have to give the dogs pride of place on the website.
Because they were instrumental in getting the minds together.
Exactly. They were part of the founding. The dogs have become somewhat controversial amongst staff, because I have insisted that it be a dogs section. I am happy for people to list non-dog pets, but I'm not...
No cats.
They are allowed to put their cats up there, but I'm not calling it dogs and cats. I'm just calling it dogs. And so the cat...
Or snakes, or rabbits,
yeah, anything.
Or cockroaches, hey, you know, or whatever pets you have.
Jeff does happen to have some pet cockroaches at his house, just for the record.
We got all sorts of pets at my house.
I'm terrified now.
Whole nother thing.
Yeah, Jeff's just hoping they don't escape and proliferate.
They're very nice, actually. Okay, so the dogs. We talked about the dogs.
Well, okay, I have a question to go back to what you're doing that's different from others.
What we're doing that's different from others is that we have dogs.
Yeah, well, that's
the
true.
Most important
okay.
thing.
So the website is definitely different, no doubt about it. So another, every time there's a score that comes out and it comes from these different places, people start to wonder if there's political leanings one way or the other. And everybody claims they're politically, neutral, apolitical, whatever you want to call it. But that's maybe not necessarily true. But I even say, I know you're not going to say, oh, we're Republican or we're Democrat or something like that. But are there like certain types of policies that you would advocate for? Or is it just literally whatever somebody dreams up in DC, we're going to score it?
Yeah. So we are not advocating for specific policies, which is not to say that members of the team do not have policy preferences. People obviously have policy preferences. But that is not what we are here to do. And that is not to say that the policy preferences of the team always align with each other, because they do not. Our thing is really just, we are here to provide scores. And, I think one thing we do feel very strongly about is signaling places where we feel more or less certain in those scores. So for instance, our macro work is very much a work in progress. And we have tried to signal throughout our write-ups of like, this is a work in progress. This is something we are thinking through. Because I do think, for all of these things, you're trying to guess at what's going to happen in the future. And there are so many places where you're having to make an assumption or make a judgment call. And our goal is to be as transparent about those as possible. And also flag the places where we're like, look, we've had to make enough judgment calls or assumptions here that, this is our guess. Take it with a grain of salt and, let's see what happens.
And that's a little bit different from what you might see, for example, if you look at the CBO's budget score or the Joint Committee on Taxation. They're not going to say here, or maybe they do, I don't know, but I don't think they detail all the different decision nodes along the way and say there's a confidence interval here and a confidence interval there and a confidence interval there. And at the end, we get this thing and the confidence interval is this wide. They don't really say that, right? They just say, here's the number. And
I mean, to be clear, we have not been putting confidence intervals around what we have put out. That's been
maybe not like specific statistical ones, but if you're telling me what you're telling me that you're kind of caveating, like this is a work in process or something, that's sort of an implicit.
Yes. No, it is an implicit confidence interval. I mean, one thing we've talked about is the UK budget entity, whose name I'm of course now forgetting, has like color scoring that they put out with what they do. So if it's something they're really certain in, it'll be green. Like, we're really pretty certain this is what this is going to cost. Less certain, it'll be yellow. And even less certain, it'll be, orange, red. Like, you can use this. That is your decision. We took darts. We threw them at a board. This is what it came up with. It's our best, best guess, guys.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, we've asked several people, how accurate their scores end up being. So just for background, I mean, Jeff's favorite topic in tax literally is scoring. And we probably talked about scoring as much as anything else on this podcast. And we've asked several times people the question, like, how accurate do your scores end up being? And the answer usually is something like, well, with any specific item in a bill or something, it's like not that accurate, but the aggregate amount tends to be fairly accurate. Which I don't know if that makes me feel good or bad, but it is interesting to just think about the ex post accuracy and the forecast errors and so forth of any scoring thing.
I mean, one thing we've talked about is going back and, kind of rescoring things with our methodology and seeing kind of how we would have done in 1962. We have not done that for a range of reasons, not least of which is data from 1962, very hard to come by for certain things. But, I think it is a really hard question. I mean, the one I kind of always think about is the tanning beds in the ACA. Like, how do you come up with a score for that provision? CBO did, like, shout out to CBO, but that's hard. That's really, it's not like there's a survey of tanning bed usage that comes out every year. And so this is a very long-winded way of saying a relatively banal statement, which is scoring is hard. And I have a lot of respect for everyone who does it and has been doing it for decades.
So let's talk a little bit about so you haven't been around that long. It's a relatively new endeavor, but you have produced a few kind of products, one of which is some work on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've done there? First of all, like, why did you decide to focus on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act? It seems like if you're kind of like the value add over everybody else is talking about the impact. So is there some impact component to it? And then just what you've done with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
I mean, the reason to look at TCJA is because it's such a live issue for next year of what's going to happen with some of these expiring provisions, that it's sort of impossible to be in this space and not look at it. You know, I think some of our really interesting work on impacts and benefits is on the child tax credit side. I will say one thing on the TCJA side that we've done that is different is come up with these measures of how changes in the tax code would impact the amount of time that people spend doing their taxes. You know, one of the things that people said about the TCJA was, you know, you'll be able to do your taxes on a postcard. I think we all know that for many people, they will never be able to do their taxes on a postcard. But, you know, how close did they get to that? What percent of people, you know, under this provision, under the TCJA, are more likely to just have relatively simple taxes where technically the government could just file for them and it would be fine?
Well, if you put enough people under the standard deduction,
right,
and they all make W-2 income, like, there you go. You're like set.
And, you know, how do you think about people's time impacts? Now, to be clear, there may be people whose time to do their taxes went up and then they got a massive tax cut and they may feel that that was totally worth it. But it is an impact to think about. I think on the TCJA side, the main thing that we've done that is different is looking on the macro side over a longer period of time. And the thing that we found there is that, you know, different versions of extending the TCJA will increase economic growth in the short run. Now, when I say short run, I'm talking about like within the budget window. So the level of real GDP is higher if you extend TCJA for the first, you know, 9, 10-ish years. But then eventually, the deficit implications catch up with you, and it starts crowding out other investments. And if you look at the end of 30 years, the real GDP level is lower under TCJA extension than if you had stuck with current law.
What do you mean by the deficit implications?
So if we extend TCJA, it is likely that it will not be paid for. President Trump has said that he would pay for extending the TCJA by putting tariffs on it. I have not yet seen a more concrete plan on what that would look like, you know, sort of unclear. But I think many people's assumption is that extending the TCJA would have pretty substantial deficit and debt impacts, the same way that passing the TCJA in the first place did. Yep. And so if you're increasing the deficit, if you're increasing the national debt, particularly at a time when the economy is doing very, very well and there is not a need for additional fiscal stimulus, you are probably crowding out other economic activity that would.
So, I mean, if you're talking about 30 years out, this is a question a little tiny bit more in the weeds, but I do think it's super interesting and I think it'd have a huge impact. What kind of discount rate do you use? This has been a matter of like recent controversy. 30 years, you get a very different answer if it's 2 versus 3 versus 7. So how do you think about things that happen a long ways away?
100%. We are using like conventional budget ways of doing this, which is to say we are not using a discount rate. But it is a really important question.
Right, you're not using a discount rate. So something that happens in 30 years.
Same as today.
Time has no value.
Time has no value. Either the budget lab or CBO.
This is blasphemy.
You should have been an accountant because accountants never worry about time value of money. All those financial statements, there's like no such thing as time value of money. Like we just ignore it perfectly. So there you go.
But I think it is a really, really important question, particularly as you get further out. And frankly, as you get into some of these questions around benefits or costs to the next generation, how do we value those? Like, I mean, this is going to sound incredibly callous, but do we care if the next generation is going to benefit from or have to pay for the decisions we make today? Like, I feel that that's something that I care about, but other people may care about that less or more than I do. And how do you account for that? And yes, obviously, I was just in the Biden administration, so I'm very familiar with these conversations about discount rates.
Whether you care or not may depend on the number of children that one has. And in the case of me and Jeff, that's quite a large number. So we care quite a lot. Or maybe we don't like our kids. And so maybe we don't care at all. I'm not sure.
I have to say, currently at the Budget Lab, and this is a running joke, we have 3 members of staff who are about to have 4 babies. And so the amount of caring about future generations at the Budget Lab is about to increase quite substantially.
Dramatically. There you go.
So I just want to get clear. What exactly do you mean when you say you use a discount rate of 0? How does that work?
So if you like, when you look at what CBO does, they're adding up the costs in each of the 10 years.
So 10 well, yes, 30 years is a lot different than 10
but
years.
They don't, 100%. But they don't go beyond 30, right?
They don't go beyond 10,
yeah. Do they?
No.
Yeah, they don't go beyond 10. So
no, I mean, I think it's a really, really important question. I think it's a really interesting question. And it really changes the calculus on how you may be thinking about some of these longer term investments. But it's not something we've currently played around with.
There's another differentiation factor. You could become the first to put in a discount rate.
A suggestion for the Budget Lab. Maybe you've already thought of this. Are you ready?
Yeah. If it's about cats, I'm not taking the suggestion, but please continue.
No cats.
No cats. Okay. I think you need lab coats like that you use when you're doing science.
Yeah.
You need lab coats that say the Budget Lab, and you could wear them sometimes. Because if you have a lab, you gotta have lab coats.
So one, I should note that one of the dogs is in fact a lab, and we would like to get him in a lab coat. But we did get hats for everyone that say Budget Lab with our little picture on them. But we were informed afterwards by many people that this was a huge mistake and the swag that we handed out should have been lab coats instead of hats. So that is on us.
We have a faculty member here at UNC who we talk about like being scientists, right? We're doing research, being scientists. He had a lab coat and like before he ran regressions, he would put on his lab coat.
He also, if it's the one I'm thinking of when I was a PhD student many years ago at UNC, would wear the lab coat to research presentations sometimes. Yeah.
If we wanted to be a real sciencey.
So he could be in the audience with his lab coat on. All right. So there you go. That's something you could do at the Budget Lab to.
I guess they already thought about it. They already.
Yep. Sorry.
That'd be very interesting.
We'll come up with a better one next time.
All right. Well, Martha, thank you so much. This is it's been very interesting, and we look forward to seeing more and more things come out of the Budget Lab to help us understand the workings of our future economy. So thank you so much.
Thanks. We're excited.
I'm Scott Dyring, professor of accounting at Duke University, and I'm joined, as always, by Jeff Hoops, my co-host at the University of North Carolina. And our guest today has been Martha Gimbel, who is the executive director of the Budget Lab. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll chat with you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.